She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted.
Hello, and welcome to The Persistence. This is She Who Persisted, the Nasty Podcast. In case you don't know our voices yet, this is Elizabeth. And today we're continuing our series on witches with a discussion about witches in popular culture. For this episode, I interviewed a special guest, Aileen Nichols, who does some very interesting research on representations of witches in feminist poetry and pop culture. We talk about everything from the cauldron and early modern cooking, to second wave feminist poetry, to Buffy, Bewitched, and the originals. Before we move on to the interview, just a quick note about the audio. There were some, let's call them technical issues, during the recording. Basically, my computer died. So if you notice a difference in audio quality, that's why. We think the content of the interview definitely makes up for it, so we hope you enjoy. Now, on to the interview. Aileen, thank you so much for joining us and for talking to us about witches in our special October series of podcasts about witches.
My pleasure.
So why don't you introduce yourself a little bit about the work that you do and, you know, the research that you do and how it has to do with witches?
Okay. My name is Aileen Nichols. I got my degree in humanities at the University of Texas at Dallas. And my dissertation was on witches, and I had also written about them previous to that as well. And my dissertation talked not only about witches in popular culture, but it also looked at how feminists in the 70s and 80s were using the witch sort of as an avatar to express their position.
And by avatar, you mean kind of a like symbolic figure, correct?
Yeah, it was, well, what happens, because it was poetry. When you write poetry, a lot of times the narrator and the author are the same person. So when you make a statement like, I am a witch, you're referencing not just the narrator, but often to yourself. The interesting thing I discovered was that, so I'm looking at feminist poetry, and what I discovered was that the people who were attracted to feminist poetry, or to writing it, were women who had sort of not only an outsider identity as a feminist, but a second outsider identity as well. So they're women of color, lesbians, working class feminists. So I worked with people like Audre Lorde, Gloria Anzaldúa, Cheryl Clark, actually even a little bit of Yoko Ono. I used one of her song lyrics as well. It's called I'm a Witch.
I'm sure there are plenty of Beatles fans who would also say that Yoko Ono is some sort of a witch as well. Some of our listeners know that most of the women on the podcast met at a conference on evil women, and that is how we met as well. So kind of bringing everything full circle here. In an earlier episode of our podcast, one that's coming out, you know, Tuesday, the October 10th, or that has come out on Tuesday, October 10th, we talk about some kind of stereotypes regarding witches, many of stereotypes which were perhaps made popular by the Malleus Maleficarum. And one aspect we didn't really talk about was the inclusion of a cauldron in witchcraft ritual. What have you researched about the witch's cauldron, and how has that been reflected in maybe popular culture?
Well, it is actually very interesting because at the time the Malleus was written, the cauldron was, of course, just the normal thing that that women use to cook. But you not only have those fun Malleus guys, you know, saying women are all about uncontrolled sexuality and evil. You also have this guy named Hans Sachs, who actually says, well, if witches are evil with their cauldrons, then the wife, the woman in the kitchen who's actually doing the cooking, must be taught to be good. She must be the good wife, because the last thing you want is somebody who's evil cooking food for the family. And so the cauldron appears both sort of as a non-lethal thing in normal households, but then when it's used outside the household with witches, it's sort of like a counterexample for women as how to not be the evil witch, how to keep your sexuality under control by cooking within certain parameters. So, for example, the cook was usually young and female, and the cauldron And one of the reasons the cauldrons are so closely related to sexuality is because it feels like, it felt like pregnancy in a way. You put some ingredients in, they're nothing like what they're going to be like. You add some stuff, you wait a while, and something brand new comes out, right?
That is fascinating, especially even with the shape of a cauldron or even a pot that time, the roundness of it that kind of reflects the roundness of a pregnant belly.
Absolutely. And it was also one of the few things that women were allowed to own. Most property was under the husband, but the cauldron and a few other things could actually be owned by the woman.
That's interesting. It's also interesting. I know Hans Sachs from his Passion Carnival plays. Just as a Germanist, I know that, but I had no idea that he had this whole discourse where he talks about creating good women and using the cauldron or the pot for good works.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And so in order to sort of control women, we had certain conditions, right? The women who did the cooking were generally young because women didn't live to be that old. So, you know, most women were fertile for most, if not all, of their life cycles. They cooked in the kitchen, as opposed to, you know, the bad witch who's out in the field somewhere cooking evil things. The contents were obviously different. The good wife learned what was good, healthy food and how to cook it, as opposed to the witch who's throwing in Eye of Newt and so forth. And then the good wife is cooking at an appropriate time. She's cooking right before dinner, which was really important then because food wasn't going to last. You know, if you kill an animal, you have no refrigeration, so you have to cook right before it's eaten. And so all of those things sort of separated the good wife from the bad witch via the cauldron. Well, you'd ask me about popular culture as well. Of course, back then, the popular culture we get is Macbeth, right? So you got your three witches at the cauldron doing all the things that a good wife does not do. But even up into the 20th century, we still have a lot of things that are sort of associated with the cauldron. But what we had in the 20th century is this new thing called the good witch, which is like Samantha in Bewitched. And good witches actually cook just like you and I do on a stove for the most part. They very seldom use cauldrons. It was more the bad witches or the people who were no longer, for whatever reason, considered acceptable to society, who then in popular culture end up doing the cooking.
Let me ask you about, I don't know how much you know about, and I don't remember really a lot about Bewitched, except that I know that her mother was kind of a bad witch and that she was a relatively good witch. So do we get in Bewitched this dichotomy between Samantha and, I'm not going to remember her mother's name, but her mother?
Yeah, I can't remember her name either. Well, we do to some degree, because when we start, well, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about this later too, but when we start developing the idea of the good witch, she has certain qualities. And one of them is that she's young, she's straight, she's the middle or upper class. And the thing that Samantha's mother-in-law breaks, of course, is she's no longer young. And so, and she does have that bad witch thing going. And I believe from time to time, she's actually seen with, you know, doing the cauldron thing as well.
Yeah, I just remember her being almost like a even a bad version of Mrs. Roper from Three's Company. Like just the, she pops in from time to time. She has almost moo-moos and but she also has like the makeup and trying to appear younger while still being older, which is also an issue that comes up in fairy tales and other things like that. So yeah, I just have this very distinct memory of her very bright purple or bright green eyeshadow from the 80s, 70s and 80s.
And kind of going up at the side of the eye.
Yes, yes.
So you have that sort of hat witch look thing going.
Absolutely. Do we ever see good witches putting horrible things, fertile, good, young women putting terrible things in their cauldrons? Or is it always that the young, presumably fertile women are good witches?
Well, that's an interesting question. The one I can think of is, who's a good witch who puts horrible things into a cauldron was Hermione Granger. Remember when she makes the Polyjuice potion? I looked it up on the Harry Potter wiki, and apparently Polyjuice potion consists of lacewing flies, leeches, powdered bicorn horn, knot grass, buckwheat, shredded boomslang skin, and a bit of the person one wants to turn into.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, we think of Hermione as a relatively good witch. As, I mean, you know, contemporary popular culture.
Right. And things don't go quite as well as they should either. I mean, it's almost like there's a penalty for doing that, right? Because she accidentally gets a cat hair in there and gets turned into half cat. Cat and ends up hiding in the bathroom while the boys go off and have the adventures.
Well, yes. I mean, and maybe that's the punishment of a good witch, a good girl, a good woman, young woman trying to do bad things, you know, it'll backfire on her and terrible things will happen.
You know, another one that's really interesting is Roman Polanski's Macbeth.
That's a really interesting movie.
It is. And you remember one of the witches there is young.
And I always thought it was fascinating that Lady Macbeth looks exactly like Sharon Tate.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we watched this film when I was in high school and we had just done Macbeth and I was writing a paper in high school and we had these other images of Macbeth, which is, who's always like a dark haired woman because, you know, I'm a brunette too. So dark haired women are shady, but his Macbeth looks just like Sharon Tate. And I just thought, you know, I wonder if this was done before or after his wife was killed. And it was done after Sharon Tate had been murdered. So I think it was his attempt to kind of, cause she doesn't also seem as evil. She just seems kind of crazy.
Well, and it's so bloody. I figured that had to have been because it all come after that as
absolutely,
well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the witches, the young witch.
And actually, I do have a theory that Lady Macbeth is sort of a witch as well, or a witch figure. Because in a lot of ways, she has so much in common with the witches out on the hearth. But the young witch, yes. And you know how she's like keeps showing her lifting her skirt to show everybody what's underneath and that sort of thing. So we have that sort of idea of uncontrolled sexuality. But instead of using a hearth or a cauldron, they dig a hole in the earth and they put like somebody's arm and all kinds of other icky stuff in there, which I thought was interesting because the earth is also often seen as female. And so that could also be
interesting. Have you seen any efforts to change these stereotypes in movies and shows? And if so, why do you feel that the creators of these media would want to challenge these kind of pre-established notions of good and bad witches as either young versus old, good versus evil, attractive, appealing versus not appealing?
Yeah, actually, one of the clearest examples, I think, is Maleficent, where I think they really did try to challenge some of those sort of strict binaries. You know, you're either good and you're like this, or you're evil and you're like this. And I think they did it because in part they wanted to break through some of those stereotypes and maybe see women as more multidimensional. Because so often, you know, as we've kind of made an assumption throughout this conversation, woman and witch are kind of synonymous.
Sure.
But in reality, nobody's either purely good or purely bad, which they pretty much stayed at the end of Maleficent.
Yeah. You know, I feel like we also get, I think you mentioned Harry Potter, especially as the films progress, we definitely get a sense that younger witches are also willing and able to do more, I don't want to say difficult spells, but more morally ambiguous spells if the situation warrants it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that moral ambiguity gets brought into it.
Yeah. Do you think that these stereotypes have kind of fluctuated over time? Do you think that, especially in popular culture, but generally over time, do we see more ambiguity now? Or do you see there still being a pretty stark contrast between good and evil in terms of women and their presentation in pop culture?
You know, I think there are two sides of it. In some ways, you know, I don't think a lot has changed because when we look at the qualities of a bad witch, they're pretty stable. They tend to be non-white or over-sexual or lower class and so forth. But in other ways, especially with good witches, what you see is, you know, they've got jobs outside the home. They can be sexually active as long as they're not sluts. And so I think sort of the roles have expanded, but I think there is a tendency to still sort of reinforce that dichotomy and even strengthen it in some way. On the other hand, it's a really complicated question. On the other hand, I think what you see now is witches are centered in the story, which is part of when we were talking about the ambiguity, right? Because if they're a side character, they can just be evil or they can just be good. But once they become the main part of the story, you got to do something with them. And so there has to be some struggle between good and evil. So in that sense, I do think that we are seeing something a little bit different. Oh, yeah. And then the other thing I would say is looking at like the 1990s and the 2010s, which were two periods where we had suddenly a whole bunch of popular culture representations of witches. In the 1990s, you have things like Charmed, Sabrina, Buffy the Vampire Slayer with Willow, Witches of Eastwick, Practical Magic. And one big thing then was they had to hide their identity in order to fit in. You didn't want anybody to know that you were a witch. And in a lot of ways, people have drawn parallels to that and LGBTQ people who have been closeted. And they also had, like, there were always councils of men. So, for example, in Charmed, there was a council that ultimately told them what they could and couldn't do. Or Sabrina would have to go before the council that was mostly men, which would decide whether she had used her powers appropriately. And then by the time you get to the 2010s, where you've got like the Vampire Diaries, the Originals, Witches of East End, they tend to live with other supernatural beings. So it's not all about hiding their identity, you know, which you know, seemed to be a lot of the tension actually in the 1990s stuff. And the laws change. Instead of, you have to have some strict restriction on power, otherwise it's no fun, right? It's like Superman, he can do anything, what do you do with him? But the way they handle it changes. Instead of having a council of elders or whatever tell them what they can and can't do, we have this idea of natural laws. So, for example, are you familiar with Witches of East End?
I love that show so much.
It was really cool. Do you remember one of the daughters brought her aunt back to life? And then she finds out that there's that if one person is brought back to life, someone else has to die. And so it became less about sort of a social control and more about a natural control, which was an interesting change over those two periods.
What I think is really interesting about that is that there's this notion of needing to be trained, you know, because especially in Witches of East End, because the daughters hadn't been in that life, had not been trained as witches, they were not aware of the natural laws. And so there's a certain amount of initiation into adulthood or becoming a witch, you know, the rites of passage that they weren't familiar with. And so, you know, even though they're adult by the time they're in this time period in Witches of East End, they still have to go through a kind of coming of age that you get in a lot of fairy tales and you get in a lot of other stories, but with much younger kids.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. And what's interesting, too, is that actually seems to be a fairly common thread, because if you look back to the 1990s shows like Sabrina, she doesn't know she's a witch until her 16th birthday. Charmed, the three sisters find out late that they're witches. And so that whole initiation does seem to be something that carries through.
Yeah. I mean, even Harry Potter, you know, I mean, even though he's a kid when he finds out that he's a witch, he's unusual in that he is witch born and doesn't find out that he is a witch until later, though he's 7. So he goes through a normal coming of age. But had he been a witch and known he was a witch, he probably would have at least known about the life of witches.
So do you think, since witches, aside from Harry Potter, tend to be women, do you think that coming of age is related to being female?
I do. You know, I think some of it has to do with this protection, because the whole reason that a lot of these female characters were not told that they were witches was to protect them. And I deal with fairy tales and I teach some courses on fairy tales. Some of that is to keep them innocent, keep them away from harm. But what I think is so interesting is that these are fully adult women who are still trying to be protected by their families for a variety of reasons. You know, in Witches of East End, these women have died and been reborn, you know, however many times because of this curse. In Charmed, they're trying to both protect and make sure that they're prepared for being the power of three. But I think, I mean, I don't want to say that it's like an infantilization, but I do think that it's this attempt to protect women from things that are out there to harm them. Yeah.
Interesting. And what's interesting, too, is I think Willow is a little bit different in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because it's not about protecting her at all. It's about her discovering this new world. It's about knowledge, which is sort of consistent with what they've done with her in terms of being good at computers and so forth. Here's another skill. Here's another thing that you can learn, as opposed to it sort of being...
Well, and she seeks it out too, right? I mean, one of her things is that she's kind of seeking knowledge, seeking not power per se, but different types and forms and methods of exercising knowledge.
Whereas a lot of the other good witches not only aren't seeking it out, some of them just, at times at least, don't even want it.
Yeah, exactly. So do we see the witch as a signal of kind of shifting gender roles? I mean, we have Harry Potter as a witch. I don't know how many other male witches we can point to other than the evil kind of warlocks in Charmed.
Well, and we could actually go back to the cauldron a little bit too, because we were just talking about Buffy. There are a couple of different episodes of Buffy where the cauldron does some interesting things gender-wise. There's one scene in which the witches have left the guys in charge of preparing a potion, right? And so they're doing their very best. And it's a scene, it's played for humor, you know, two guys in the kitchen cooking. So in a sense, it's actually more of the same in terms of not much of a shift in gender roles. But there's also this idea that their girlfriends have actually drawn little stick figures to show them how to do it because they're afraid they're so incompetent at it. And so that actually kind of reinforces, I guess, rather than signals a shift.
Yeah, and I can't think of any. When we have good witches, they're almost always female. And when we have bad witches, we have a mix of both male and female. So there's this sense that both women and men can be witches and can, or warlocks. I guess in the Charmed world, they're two different things. But they can both be dangerous, both women and men.
Right. Yeah, and I think the whole idea of warlock is interesting, though, because even though it means sort of the same thing, a guy witch, a girl warlock, there's a whole different set of connotations attached to it. Warlock you think of as, I don't know, sort of having this more independent power.
Let me talk to you a little bit about independence, though. You know, we often see, we have individual witches, but we often see them in a community. And we talked about this a little bit, and we talked about the notion of these, like, councils of men, which I always thought was so weird. But it makes sense. I mean, we have to have a male body to control these aberrant women. Otherwise, like, it doesn't make sense to a lot of people. But the fact that a lot of witches are not single witches, that they're witches that come together in communities, we don't call them covens. I mean, I think that people get scared of the idea of the coven, but they do tend to form in communities of other witches. They either seek them out or are already in kind of built-in witch communities.
That's true. And if you think about it, that goes all the way back to Macbeth with the three witches. Even as outsiders, they have a community. And there's a really interesting book of poetry called The 13th Witch. It was written in like the 1970s. I believe the person who wrote it, her last name was Blue. Shelley Blue.
Okay.
And the entire book is about the idea of finding community and using the witch as a figure and a way to do that. So that seems to be something that's been sort of consistent throughout the history of witchiness.
So, question for you about 13, quickly. Is that a typical number in covens?
It is. Yeah, and I'm really intrigued and curious about numbers and how they're used and why. Because I've noticed that fairy tales, a lot of times things happen in three.
They do, but what's really fascinating for me, and we talk about the Disney version of Sleeping Beauty, which is where we have Maleficent.
Right.
In the original Grimm's version, it's 13 fairies.
Really?
So, so there are 13 fairies, but they only had 12 place settings. And so Maleficent gets screwed, or the 13th fairy gets screwed, and then she brings the curse about. And so in the original Grimm's version, I'll say original. I can't say original because we all know there's no original to fairy tales. But so the original, like 1812 Grimm's version, there are 13 fairies. And in the 1857 version that they kind of revised over time, it's 13 wise women.
Huh.
So it's no longer even fairies. It's like wise women with magical powers.
That's interesting because it sounds so positive.
Yeah, right. and 12 of them are very positive. And the 13th one theoretically could have been positive if they had left her a seat at the table.
Right. And I don't think until, even with the witch, I think maybe the Disney version does mention her being a witch. Does anybody before that ever even refer to her as a witch?
I don't know. I know in the version she's just referred to as a wise woman and they don't give a name, which is not surprising because a lot of fairy tales don't offer like specifics about characters, except for randomly the witch in Rapunzel. But yeah, no, I mean, I don't think we get it. We don't get a name for her. She's unnamed. She's not called a witch. She's just part of this group of 13, either fairies or wise women.
And then I think the first time I tried to trace this back from the French, actually, and the first time I could find when she was actually called a witch was in the first Disney version. And it happens really so quickly, you could almost miss it.
And the Disney version is theoretically based on the Perrault version of the fairy tale, I believe, which I think only has the three fairies and then the evil fairy. But yeah, I mean, or the evil witch. But I think that's really interesting that we have this cultural number of 13 that is associated with covens. We have this in at least in the German fairy tales, that these fairies from Sleeping Beauty are in 13s, and that they're not necessarily bad.
Yeah, I wonder if it's like the fifth wheel, you know? 12 is a nice, even number. You can set them at a long table across from each other. But you get the 13th person, what do you do with them?
That is very true. What do you do with the random, left-out woman?
And so she's the one who doesn't fit. She's the one who's just kind of there. And we get really uncomfortable when we don't have systems for things. In fact, that's one of the distinguishing qualities of the witch. There's a woman named Mary Douglas who was actually looking at tribes that had witchcraft in them, or that had the role of a witch. And what she found was that these were the people who couldn't be put neatly into categories. And when they couldn't be put neatly into categories, then people became suspicious of them. What could they be up to if they didn't quite fit anything? And so that might work with the number 13.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we have this cultural association of 13 with being kind of an unlucky number. It's a prime number. It's a prime number that seems like an uncomfortable number. You know, we have the Friday the 13th, and we have, yeah, I mean, it's something that is, It's a societal like unease, I feel like, around the number 13.
And you know, 3 and 7 are also prime numbers, and those are the other two that we seem to have so much sort of cultural baggage associated with.
Yeah, I feel like we don't do anything with 11 though. We've got to figure out what our cultural baggage around the number 11 is. Because 3 and 7 are kind of like holy numbers. They're associated with like the 7 deadly sins and the 7 cardinal virtues and things like that. The 3 is associated with the Trinity. If 13 is bad, then what happened to 11?
Yeah. Well, and I don't know, Mircea Eliade wrote about witches as a sort of degraded holy symbol. So based on that, even would be considered to have sort of a holy meaning to it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and if we have 3 and 7 as these kind of holy symbols or holy numbers, to have 13 as something that is, you know, kind of a perversion of that, something that's kind of the opposite, a mirror image of it, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So do you see at all the portrayal of witches as an attempt for society to shift back to traditional gender roles? And I think maybe our conversation about how these women in a lot of contemporary shows in pop culture are going through this rite of passage that we typically associate with younger women and younger boys, maybe that's where we see this attempt to kind of go back to traditional ideas about women.
Well, and I also think we've been looking mostly at sort of fantasy shows, but there are the horror shows, which I think are much more conservative, much more backlashy. So, for example, Salem, where abortion is just flat out evil. Lesbianism is perversion. And you have what somebody referred to as torture porn, where they just seem to enjoy showing women being hurt. And then you have like,
yeah, and
go ahead.
No, I was going to say the same thing you are. American Horror Story.
Yeah, American Horror Story. Just sort of one sort of bad trope after another, starting with the young woman who has the vagina dentata, who's, you have sex with her, you die. And so that sort of dangerous sexuality, the older woman who will do anything to stay alive, to be young again, just one after another. The original is
well,
also.
And in that one, we also have race as well, because we have the voodoo witches as well.
Right. And they actually sort of set up women of different races in opposition to each other as sort of a power struggle even.
Absolutely. That women aren't allowed to be, you know, even though there's a coven, the women in the coven are fighting against one another for power or whatever. Women of various races are pitted against one another. Yeah, that's interesting. So I haven't seen the originals.
It's apparently a spinoff of The Vampire Diaries. I have not seen much of Vampire Diaries, but I watched a season or two of the originals. And
okay.
Again, there you have that sort of race thing. So when they have a witch in the body of a black woman, which I say that way because witches kind of, some of them switch bodies from time to time in that show, they become angry and vengeful. And so it feels like black women are angry and vengeful is one of the things that keeps getting done over and over through the witch.
So even though we would like to think that representations of witches have become more progressive and less maybe stereotypically focused on society's representations of strong women as bitches or strong black women as angry black women, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. And I think part of what's happened is that we're getting a lot more variation in representation now based on how our viewing has changed. So we don't have sort of this one sort of monolithic idea of what a witch or what women are. And part of it is we're not all watching the same shows anymore. So, you know, Bewitched got a huge chunk of the audience. I mean, more people than any of the more recent ones to watch, because it was aimed at everybody, whereas now we're getting a little nichier with various modes like online streaming of delivering media.
In one way, that's really good because we get a lot of different representations of women and a lot of different depictions of witches that could be something that, you know, if I don't identify with this version in the originals, maybe I identify with this other version in American Horror Story or Harry Potter. But on the other hand, it allows for people to choose not to confront things that maybe they're not comfortable with.
Yeah. One of the things that really bothered me was Salem, which was conceived and produced totally by men, which may or may not be relevant. But the underlying idea is it's all right to kill witches or kill women who are witches, although they had a few men, but they're mostly women, because witches are real, which felt an awful lot to me like saying, well, it was okay to kill Jews because Jews really were evil. It was really problematic. And I didn't feel like it got discussed very much. And I think part of it is because we don't have sort of a central cultural thing where we get together and discuss that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the Twitter sphere would be the one place where you would get Twitter and maybe social media, places like the Huffington Post or whatever. People do express their opinions about shows there, I think. And I think that people on Twitter have been really pretty good about calling out shows when they're, you know, racist or sexist or when they're just doing something really problematic. But I don't know, you know, maybe people weren't watching Salem because it was just too much.
Yeah. But the other problem is, are you going to be going to Twitter to look at that sort of thing if you're not already sort of in agreement with the people who are going to say whatever they're going to say?
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think that before, when, you know, everybody the next day would stand around the water cooler and talk about whatever show, then you had a sense that there was a community of people that were really talking about it. And even if it wasn't necessarily the show for you, there were only four channels. Three channels probably. So it didn't matter. Like, you didn't have any other options. But now you have so many options that you can just choose to block things out.
And that also has, on the other hand, an upside, which means that more voices are being heard. So maybe by fewer people, but people who maybe before didn't even get a chance to speak or say anything now have an outlet for doing so. So you do get a broader range of opinions if you could find a way to actually tap them all.
Yeah, a multiplicity of opinions is always better than just a handful. And I think the fact that we're getting more female directors, female writers that are contributing to a lot of these shows, I think that also helps because it brings in a different perspective.
Well, one of the bits of research I did when I was working on The Witch was, this sounds slightly insane, but I went to IMDb and I went through and looked at all the various shows about witches, and I counted the number of creators who were women, the number of writers who were women, the number of directors who were women. And I created a big spreadsheet so they could actually find out how did having women involved in the process change how witches were being represented. And not surprisingly, when women are involved in the creation of witches, the portrayals tend to be more favorable.
So what shows had more women involved in the process?
All of those shows we talked about, Charmed, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Witches of East End, Practical Magic, not only did they have more women involved in the process than the other type of witch shows, they had more women involved in the process than the average show on TV.
Oh, so, that's really interesting.
Yeah, there's a report called Boxed In by Martha M. Lauzon. And she said 2000 to 2001 season, 43% of the writers on the television show, no, that was me, 40% of the writers on Charmed were women, and 50% on Buffy were women. But she gave me the average overall. The average number of women writers on most sitcoms and dramas was 27%. And then I looked at the 2014-2015 season, which had The Witches of East End and The Originals. And 53% for The Witches of East End, 51% for The Originals. Overall, 26% of television writers were women. So,
oh, wow. That explains a lot of why I really enjoyed Witches of East End, because I thought that the storylines were really interesting. I thought that the characters were really well developed, that even the kind of evil character, like the evil female character, like she was a complicated character.
Yeah, yeah. And okay, I have to admit, I got a little sick of the whole romance end of it. I thought they could have just dialed it back. But
I could have done without all of that romance stuff too. Absolutely. Give me just a good, like, witches and weirdness and I'm fine.
Yeah, but they did do that. They did give us some interesting characters.
Yeah, no, I agree. So do you think that women should keep an eye on the witch in popular culture to maybe see shifts moving away from stronger independent women or portrayals of witches that are maybe more complicated to show that there is maybe a greater understanding of stronger women? Or do you think the witch is maybe, I don't want to call it a bellwether, but maybe, does it tell us something, portrayals of witches in pop culture, does it tell us something about the direction society is going?
That's an interesting question because, like we discussed, the witches right now seem to be going in all different directions. You know, we have some really strong witches and some that we'd rather not be associated with. In terms of whether or not what they tell us, I think maybe in terms of an overall directional shift, you know, if we looked at witches in popular culture in the 40s and 50s versus now, I think we might see a general shift. But I don't know that it's there's enough, because there are so many voices, I think it would be very hard to tell in the short run. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah, you have to do kind of a longitudinal looking from the beginning of popular culture, which is representation in popular culture, to today. We see a much more complicated image of it as opposed to this kind of really black and white, good, bad dichotomy.
And we also have to keep in mind that people make television shows and movies to make money, and they tend to be very conservative industries.
Sure.
What might be interesting, actually, would be to look at how the term witch is used in, say, the political arena.
Oh, nice.
I think that might give you some really interesting data in terms of where we're going.
And are you thinking in terms of like a derogatory term?
Well, Hillary Clinton was called a witch as a derogatory term. And I think that said some very specific things about what made people uncomfortable about her. On the other hand, you have Trump claiming that there's a witch hunt against him, which would place him as the witch, as the innocent victim. So it has a totally different meaning in that context.
Yeah. To like claim the identity of witch, even though you're the one who's like participating in witch hunts.
Yeah.
Have you seen the show Stan versus Evil?
I have not.
So I don't remember what channel it's on. I was streaming on Hulu, and just this idea of someone claiming a witch hunt, but actually being the real witch, or, you know, being the claiming a witch hunt, but so that that against themselves, which would make them the witch, but actually participating in witch hunts against other people. It just reminded me in that show, there's kind of a curse on a town, and the curse is based on this former sheriff who had gone out and done these witch hunts to, you know, murder people who were his enemies in the town. In reality, he had actually been a witch and was trying to get rid of people who might be onto him, or who were his competitors, or any number of other things. So he was a witch, and he used his position of power as a witch to then conduct witch hunts.
Huh. Interesting. And you said it's Dan versus Evil?
Stan versus Evil. It's a comedy because it's contemporary, and now it's, you know, there's a curse on this town of basically every sheriff from then on out is ends up being murdered by the spirits of these people who were murdered.
I'll have to look that up. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the storylines are very, it's very funny. It's a little irreverent, but it's also very complex in terms of this issue of the witch and the spiritual world. And the old sheriff left his office after his wife died, and you find out that his wife had actually been protecting him this whole time with spells and ancient weapons and things like that. And the only reason that he didn't die in his tenure as the sheriff is because his wife, as kind of this witch figure, had been protecting him.
Interesting. So rather than being like the good wife protecting the family, she becomes somebody who's protecting not only her family, but the entire village.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and what's interesting is all of the different ideas of the witch that come into play in popular culture. Because, you know, you've talked about the witch in fairy tales. We've talked about the actual women who were hunted down as witches and persecuted by the witch hunters. We've talked about like the mythical witch of the witches from Macbeth come from. And then there's some early prototypes as well, like Medea and Medusa. And I think all of these get kind of poured into this cauldron, if you'll excuse the expression, of popular culture and mixed together and then come out in new ways.
Yeah. And then you can kind of pick and choose. You know, what ends up happening is new witches that are created are amalgams. People pick and choose the characteristics of these various witches because these witches become tropes in a lot of ways.
And so you're always fighting that tendency because tropes are just that. They tend to sort of solidify an idea of what something is. And yet if you're wanting to, as a creative person, do something with that, you've got to sort of explode the trope.
Yeah.
And so kind of what we're looking at when we're talking about, well, do things change over time? You know, has this sort of solidified into this is what it always is, or are they finding ways to break out of it? And I think what we're finding interesting are the ways they break out of that.
Yeah. Or that they use pieces of it to then critique it in interesting ways.
Yeah. I keep going back to the Witches of East End. Do you remember at one point they took her, put her in Salem, presumably because she was hanged for being a witch. And so there's all these direct references back to historical spots too.
Yeah. Salem is a whole other thing. The actual space of Salem and how they have used the witch trials and Bewitched and all of that as a marketing ploy and tourist attraction is a whole nother level.
Yeah. Oh, and another type of witch that we see recycled a lot is the whole idea of the Wiccan too, right? The witch as sort of a new agey religious figure.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think we see that in Buffy too. You know, when Willow becomes a witch or like kind of comes into her powers, we see that there are witches represented in a lot of different ways there as well. And in Charmed, I think.
Yeah.
So as a last question, I want to ask you, what is your favorite witch in popular culture and why?
Can I have two?
Of course. There are no rules here.
Oh, good. Let's see. I do like Willow from Buffy, but I like the Dark Willow when she goes bad. Because
when she goes bad and skins the guy?
Yeah. Well, I didn't say I wanted to be her. I just like her.
Okay.
I can't even tell you why. She just is very determined. She's very motivated. She's doing this for a reason. It may be a very bad reason, but she's doing it for a reason. And the ultimate change at the end, when she stops being Dark Willow, comes about as part of this long history that she's had with another character. So I think that's very appealing. And then, of course, the other one would be The Wicked Witch of the West. Because who doesn't love The Wicked Witch of the West? She has so much fun.
Well, and I think that that actually Dark Willow also, I mean, she's grieving, right? And part of why she's Dark Willow is because she's dealing with a lot of grief. But she right. seems to also have a lot of fun. I just recall her, you know, after, I think after she skins the one character, she's like bored now and like wants to do something totally different. Like, I'm ready to have some fun and do other fun stuff.
And she, and both of those characters are angry, and women aren't normally allowed to be angry. And so to see witches who are just letting it all be out there and not worry about it is really kind of cool.
Agreed. I think that we need to have a lot more like willingness to let women express their emotions. And if it has to be through the image of a witch, then it has to be through the image of a witch.
Now, if we can only get some good witches to be angry.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking to me and taking the time to talk about witches and your research and pop culture. We really appreciate it.
Sure. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
We hope you enjoyed our interview with Aileen. If you have any questions about anything referenced in the episode, please feel free to drop us a line. Our email is shewhopersistedpodcast@gmail.com, and our homepage can be found at shewhopersisted.com. If you like our show and would like to support it, please, please subscribe wherever you listen. Rate and review us on iTunes and Facebook. We have a Facebook page and a Facebook discussion group, as well as Instagram and Twitter, where you can reach us at shepersistedpod. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay nasty. Bye.